What's up, tweeners? Welcome back to another Tweener Tennis video today here on the channel. And today we have an absolutely very fun discussion with Vaunch from the Tennis One app. Vaunch has been working with them since January, and he's probably one of our favorite people to follow on Twitter when it comes to all things tennis. And we wanted to have him on the channel to talk about what's going on in the world right now, what's going on in tennis, and how he's getting into and promoting the best sport in the world. So I really do appreciate Vaunch for being here on the channel. But before you guys enjoy our chat, make sure you are subscribed to Tweenerhead Tennis. We're trying to hit 6,000 subscribers by the end of this year. I know it's a long shot. We would love to have you guys join the channel to follow all things tennis. Make sure you leave a like, comment what you think about what we talked about today, and make sure you're subscribed to the channel. Now enjoy our chat with Vaunch about everything tennis from the Tennis One app. Vaunch, thank you so much for joining us today. Vaunch is, if you don't know who he is, working for Tennis One since January now, really up to date in, honestly, one of the best follows on tennis Twitter that you can have. And I wanted to bring you on today to kind of chat about what's going on in the tennis world and kind of get to know you and your background and just have a casual tennis chat, to be honest, and wanted to get your opinion on some things. So thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for having me. I've been a big fan of your channel, actually, the last 2 or 3 years. You had on some really great guests, and I love the content you're doing, helping grow the game, and that's what it's all about. So excited to be here.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. That means a lot. For you, how did you fall in love with the game of tennis? How did you start kind of this journey to getting to Tennis One?
Well, I guess if we start really far back, I want to say 2007, 2008, I kind of was growing up in the summers, was pretty bored, needed something to do. I tried a lot of different sports before. You know, I used to play some baseball. I used to play some soccer or football, I guess, in Europe, for those listening. And then, you know, my dad used to play recreationally, and I would just go and crash with his friends sometimes on Saturday mornings when he would play. And I just kind of loved the one-on-one aspect of it. One summer I got really bored. We picked up some rackets near a local dumpster near where we were staying at. And we kind of, me and my brother were just kind of like, all right, finders keepers, no one's taking this. And we just took it back to our garage and we just started hitting against the wall because
I love that. You know,
we were just so bored. And back then, access to tennis courts wasn't easy for me, like where I was staying at. Kind of had to drive like 20, 25 minutes away. So obviously the best solution then is to just hit against the wall and just get some reps. And I didn't really have like great fundamentals or technique or anything like that, but I just loved like the repetition. I loved like just creating strokes. I kind of just, and then my dad one summer just called me and he was watching the Wimbledon final 2008 between Roger and Rafa.
Oh,
and it just happened, of course, to be one of the greatest matches of all time. The first ever match that I watched on TV.
Really?
So from
there,
it just happened to be love at first sight. And then I started playing, I started training. I started playing tournaments and kind of, you kind of know the rest as a junior, you know, you go through it, you go through the grind of playing tournaments, practicing, training. And then kind of one summer, I actually injured my knee pretty badly. So I couldn't play for like 6 months because I had these like knee tendonitis, growing pains. And at that point, I kind of was like, okay, I've been watching quite a lot of tennis. I have some knowledge built up from my junior experience. Let's see how I can kind of use that and, you know, do something else with it, like write and podcast and do other things with it. So I started writing. I wrote for Tennis View magazine for a couple of years and I would cover the Grand Slams. And this was as a high schooler, you know, so I didn't get paid a huge salary or anything like that. Actually nothing. I kind of just volunteered to do it for free. And from there on, I kind of kept in touch with the game. I went to business school and around about COVID time, I had a blog for a while. So I would kind of just write my thoughts. It's probably somewhere on the internet at this point, somewhere in the archives, that blog, but I used to just keep up to date with all the tennis information, news and everything. And then social media came around with Twitter and everything. And kind of when the pandemic hit, that's when I went on Twitter and sort of, it's been history.
You please subscribe. Thanks.
Since then, because I feel like Twitter has just opened up so many doors to connect and meet like-minded people in the tennis world. And from there, just kind of snowballed into this.
I love that because it kind of, the Twitter became your new kind of blog spot, right? It was the place to kind of put all those thoughts in a quicker and more maybe efficient manner as well. You don't have to think about that much. You kind of just type whatever you're thinking. That was kind of the power of
That's what Twitter is, right? And whether
Yeah,
that's,
exactly.
and Twitter's very, let's be real, Twitter is a scary place. So it's nice to have some decent content where you don't have to try to figure out if something's right. But now we have community notes, and those are more funny than factual now. So
Yeah.
it makes it so much more fun. For you, when you first started writing, was there a style that you ever wanted to do or like kind of replicate? Because there are a lot of great tennis writers out there. Did you just develop your own style, or is it kind of your own voice in that manner?
I grew up consuming, different types of content. I used to read John Wertheim's Mailbag, for instance. Courtney Nguyen had a thing on Sports Illustrated. I loved reading that. I loved Peter Votto on ESPN. So those were some of the writers that I kind of looked up to. And then later on, Steve Flink as well, who then got inducted into the Hall of Fame. And I kind of just liked how he was just very straight to the point, wrote about the turning points in matches and moments that he felt like, kind of changed the course of history. So I was inspired by those kind of writers. But then as I started to realize my writing style, I started to incorporate quite a lot more stats and data and patterns and stuff like that, because I love like numbers and patterns, and kind of that's my niche. So as much as I started to focus on what was happening inside the lines, I also tried to see if there was any big picture takeaways I could take away from it, and see like if the reader had like 2 minutes, what are some of the most important things he or she would want to know, and why is this relevant? So that kind of thing. And what I love about Twitter actually is that the character limit, 280 characters or whatever it is, it like really challenges you to try to get as much
I like it.
information as you can to fit that kind of description. So it actually like I think I through Twitter as well, I kind of improved my writing and vice versa, because it's just
Really?
it forces you to kind of put large amounts of content into a small small sort of bubble, so that
Yeah.
people are people can get information quickly and that's relevant to them.
Well, you make it sound like it's the reverse side of TikTok, right? Like you have 1 minute clips, you have like 30 second pieces of news that people just scroll through, but Twitter kind of, you use it as the opposite way. You narrow down the amount of content that you have to the singular piece that everyone needs to know. And that must be hard when you're analyzing a match. And for your stats, what's the first stat you think you tweet about after a match? Like, what's the most important stat to you that you would tweet after a match that people need to know?
That's a good question. I feel like if there's one repeated pattern going on and on and on over and over again, then I kind of feel like, okay, wow, like, second serve points won or something like that. There was a huge discrepancy here. I'm just trying to find out why that is. And then what are some key points in the match where that turned out to be the case? And kind of if there's a big picture overall stat from the season, or maybe that kind of, like that match is kind of symbolic of in a way, then I try to tweet that out first. Or if there's just, because obviously there's like the stats during the match as well, but then there's kind of like the big picture, like season, career average, kind of if you zoom out and zoom in. So I like to do a little bit of both, so that you kind of get a feel for what happened in the match, but also just like, okay, this is kind of a trend to watch out for the next time, I don't know, Coco plays Iga, for instance. I just keep using
Who
that today because it's tough to go.
exactly? That's fair. And Gauff beat Swiatek, and then it officially made Sabalenka world number one, that we will eventually get to in this conversation. Because when we look at kind of, I guess Twitter is like headlines, right? Like, what's the biggest headline that's going to grab someone, that's going to make you read more, or like read the thread, at least from where I'm sitting right now. So looking at that and seeing that part of the analysis that you bring, what made, I guess, the biggest takeaway I would have for that is, for those stats, it's how much research do you do during a day that allows you to know all of this? Or how much time or how much free time do you have looking at all these stats? Or do you go to like a specific website during the day to like find everything?
Yeah, I mean, nowadays, I mean, I really appreciate Jeff Sackman, all the work that he's doing on Tennis Abstract, because I think
Oh,
that allows you
100%.
to kind of narrow down, filter a few specific things. If, like, I wanted to know something very specific, like his best of three set record in a 6 month stretch or something like that, and I find, like, oh my goodness, he's winning 95% of his matches, in the third set, that kind of tells you something about a player, right? So some stuff like that you kind of have an inkling of in your head, but maybe you don't know the exact number. Now there's other times where like I feel like because I watch so many highlights on YouTube, and because I watch so many kind of like the repetition of kind of doing this over and over season after season since 2011, I kind of have everything like ingrained in my head already from like ATP and WTA. So I feel like when it comes to head to heads or when it comes to specific things that, I might have to pull up, I kind of realize I already have it in my brain somewhere. I just have to like reach back and like find it. And kind of I trust my memory and I trust my instincts in those in that situation. And if it's obviously something that I have to get out pretty quickly, then I end up being able to do just fine, just like kind of relying on my memory in that situation. And sometimes I just kind of, because I think about these numbers so much in my brain, I'm just immediately able to sort of come up with it. But it's something I've had to develop over time. Like it doesn't just,
So
it doesn't come automatically.
you don't have a photographic memory, or you don't have one of those, like you could see it once and then remember it forever, or do you?
So actually, when it comes to numbers, I do. So like if I see a score, for instance, in a match or like a slam final or something, I'm probably not going to forget that score. Like I'm probably going to remember it.
So how, like, in baseball, how there's specific scores every year, like runs or like innings. If I asked you to say a final from this year, do you think you could do it?
Probably.
Okay, here we go. We're definitely doing this. Hold on. First one I'm gonna ask you is F. Oh, Philip, just type in. There we go. If I asked you, what was the score of the women's final in Adelaide this year?
Which one?
The first one.
There was one where Elena Ostapenko defeated Daria Kasatkina 6-3, 6-2.
Okay, let's find a harder one. How is that so easy for you?
Mean, I just
It's,
remember.
let me see, ATP. Oh, this one's probably going to be easy, but I want to know if you know the score line. Lyon 2024 men's match final.
Ooh, that's a really good one. I may actually not remember that one. Is it Pericard? Yeah.
Do you know who he played?
I want to say that he played against. You might have actually gotten me. It wasn't. I know that he won in like a third set tiebreak. He saved a match point. I
Yes.
remember that.
Could you, if you, I was to ask you this, guess the score line, what would it be?
I want to say it was like 6-4, 1-6, 7-6.
How? That's insane. What was the score of the tiebreaker?
8-6?
Close, 9-7. I'll still give it to you.
9-7, okay. And I believe he might have played Etcheverry,
He did
if I
play
remember.
Etcheverry. That's okay.
I do remember
I'm
that,
trying to
yeah.
think of a small.
I'm usually not that great with tiebreak scores, but
It doesn't matter. You just named the entire thing. Like, oh, here we go. These are all bigger tournaments, but I want to see if you know. Let's see. Oh, what was the score of the Rome final for the women?
Rome final for the women. Oh yeah, that was Iga Świątek 6-2, 6-3 against Arina
Men's.
Sabalenka. And then on the men's, you had Zverev defeating Nicolas Jarry 6-4, 6-3.
Gotcha.
Oh, was it the other way around? Six
Nope.
three, 6-4?
6-4, 7-5.
4-7, 5. Okay, yeah, you got
Okay.
me.
Okay. Moving on. I just had to test his knowledge, but still, that's so impressive. That's so impressive. And there goes my camera. So we're going to this one. Perfect. That's still impressive. Was that over time, or have you always had that kind of talent?
I think kind of I think I always kind of had it for like other stuff before I was into tennis. Like I'd remember people's birthday, I'd remember key dates and stuff
Love
of
that.
like where we went, what to what place, and then kind of just translated to tennis scores.
I love that. And one of the things, and if we go into, speaking of Zverev, this is actually a great transition. The most recent Masters 1000 title winner in Paris, defeating Hugo Humbert, the French phenom, I would say, this past week. What did you think of Zverev winning Paris, if I was to ask you?
Yeah, so I'm Zverev. Zverev for me had a really good like first half of the year. You know, he won Rome. He got to the finals of Roland Garros. He was obviously up 2 sets to one against Alcaraz. He made that Australian Open semifinal where he was 2 points away from beating Daniil Medvedev. It was up 2 sets to love. And obviously, you know, since then, I would say, you know, he's kind of been struggling on the grass. He had some knee problems at Wimbledon. He complained of having pneumonia earlier on. And you know, he'd played all those matches. Obviously, he had that famous outburst in Shanghai as well. So kind of coming into this event, you knew it was really good conditions for him because he's done really well indoors, quick hard courts, where I think the CPI was higher than it's ever been in Paris, which was a big talking point because you know, traditionally Paris has been somewhat on the slower side, but now, you know, with the tour transitioning, especially all the Masters 1000s, aside from Indian Wells, it's all trending upwards to being pretty quick.
Even with
And I think
Alcaraz
that's
complaining about the court surface, what was it, after his loss or after his victory? I can't remember when he did it.
Yeah, I think both occasions, especially right after he beat Jarry, I think he was just kind of taken by surprise because he was expecting it to be somewhat slow. He said, "I arrived a little bit later than maybe I should have," thinking the conditions were going to be a certain way, but then it actually kind of surprised him. And I think when you have Zverev's type of game style, which is make a really high percentage of first serves in, and just be an absolute wall from the baseline, it kind of lends itself to those quicker conditions really kind of help Zverev's offensive game, I feel like, more and more. And so he's able to kind of win matches like that relatively quickly. And I think he figured out some things on his forehand. But in general, I feel like the kind of tennis he played this week, we've seen it before, right? We've seen him do this at the finals twice. We've seen him win Masters 1000s. It's just about holding his nerves in the big moments in the majors where he hasn't gotten over the hump yet. So it kind of doesn't change my overall view of Zverev. It's interesting that he's now moved up to number two in the rankings. I think it shows, obviously, that he did better in the Masters 1000s this year than Carlos did, even though Carlos won two slams, made the finals of the Olympics. Anybody would take his year over Zverev's. I'm sure he would. I'm sure Zverev would say the same thing, actually. But yeah, just the fact that he got to the round of 16 or further at all the 1000s, he won two of them at the end of it. He grabbed some points in the majors at the beginning of the year. The math sort of worked in his favor, and he comes into Turin as probably the second player to beat after Sinner, I think, just based on those conditions, which definitely help his game.
It's for Zverev too to play on a surface like that. For him, like you said, he's a big baseliner. His backhand is probably his biggest weapon from the ground, if, and correct me if I'm wrong with that. Finally figured out his serve after having some struggles with it. For him too, I think it was the stat I saw was Zverev is currently on a winning streak against lefties, like
Yeah, 26 and 0
26,
coming in.
26 and 0
26 and 0
coming
coming.
in.
26 and 0 coming in. And I think he was asked about that after the final, and he said that I trained a lot with my brother growing up, obviously, who's Misha Zverev, who's a lefty, and kind of he spent a lot of time practicing with him, but also just a backhand return. It's just so much harder for players to be able to hit that wide, you know, the take that wide serve on the outside and make an opponent hit the backhand afterwards. And against lefties, you want to make them hit the backhand kind of right on their heels. And Zverev is so good from behind the baseline and getting that return with a great amount of depth and kind of getting into the pattern that he wants right away. And it's just tough for a guy like Ugo to kind of hit through him because Zverev is so good at absorbing pace. And he has that great two-hander that it just neutralizes the advantage a lot.
And Ugo probably counts on playing towards that backhand side more with his cross-court forehand than he does going down the line. While he is kind of in that line of attack off the forehand, it's not going to work, especially when you play the guys that are higher up that have that more solid backhand. There's a reason why he gets beat by those and why Zverev has been willingly being able to beat all these guys. And he's actually the only person in 2024 to win two Masters 1000 titles on two different surfaces. I should say
Yeah,
hard
that's
court
true.
and clay. And it just doesn't feel like he is world number two. You know what I mean? Like
Yeah.
his resume for 2024 is amazing. But saying that you didn't win a Grand Slam and you're still above the guy that did, but not above the guy that only won one, how does it? I don't blame the rankings. It just doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah, and I also would keep in mind that Alcaraz only played 6 out of the 9 1000s, and he was in basically the entire clay season apart from the French. So, he couldn't play Monte Carlo, he couldn't play Rome, and he also couldn't really play Rio because he hurt his ankle right before, like the third point of his match. And Zverev also played a little bit more, like he played a couple more 500s, I think a couple more 250s as well. He played the United Cup at the start of the year as well. So I think it was always kind of close between them. For even when Alcaraz had won Roland Garros and Wimbledon, I think Zverev was only like 700 to 800 points behind him. So I always kind of knew that this could be a possibility that Zverev actually finishes number two, but it's kind of one of those things where you look at it and you're like, okay, like I don't blame the ranking system because I think the ranking system for the most part is pretty good. Like we want to keep that because for the most part it does do a good job of saying who the best player in the world is. But obviously, would you rather have Alcaraz as your Zverev as your? It's like no question
It's
anybody
no
would take
question. Exactly.
anybody would
And
take Carlos is.
is he your favorite going into the finals besides Sinner?
I think based on the if there were like Turin rankings, I think I would have Sinner and Zverev at the top. I think if they're going in a match against Alcaraz right now on these type of courts, on fast indoor hard courts with altitude, if I look at the rest of the field, I feel confident that Alcaraz can beat the other players because he's pretty familiar on how to play those guys and kind of the matchups are better for him, and they're not going to take the racket right out of his hands. But a player like Sinner or Zverev, I think would probably be the favorite right now against him.
And in that field, we have the first Australian to make the year-end finals since Leighton Hewitt, what, 23 years ago? 2000, what was it, 2003,
Yeah,
2001?
2002, I believe. But yeah, that's
2002, I was close. Demonauer making his first ATP Finals appearance. And what do you, if I was to ask you for your expectations of him, what do you think his goal is coming into this year, or at least this tournament?
Yeah, I mean, certainly for me, he hasn't looked quite the same since Wimbledon, I think physically as well. And that's a huge compliment to him because he's still made the US Open quarterfinal. He's still been winning a ton of matches, qualified for this thing by getting to the quarters in Paris, and has really like put in a great amount of effort to kind of like he didn't play any of the Master Series events coming into the US Open. And credit to him because this is a guy for a while who was kind of stagnating in that 15 to 25 range in the rankings. And then last year he got his first top 15 finish, and then this year in the first half of the year he was just really good on the hard courts, especially and obviously in United Cup, but winning Acapulco again, like getting to the quarters of the French, which I think people least expected. And then obviously when he had that injury at Wimbledon, it looked pretty bad, but just the fact that he's been able to kind of make the ground and do enough since and still get that last spot at the ATP finals, like even ahead of Rublev and just behind Ruud, like it's quite an amazing achievement for him to get there. I hope he's able to be competitive and do himself justice. And I feel like there will be chances, depending on who is in his group. Like this kind of player who I think could win a match for sure with this field. And he's always going to fight for every single point. And obviously his tactics are brilliant because he's kind of a chameleon out there. He can kind of adjust to whatever you're throwing at him, and he's going to be always really difficult to put away with his speed and defense. But also I feel like he's improved his serve this year. I feel like he's become more attacking in general, and he's always been great at the net, and now he's finally utilizing all his strengths.
He's also one that kind of has adjusted his game well enough to the point where he's now being offensive. He's using his serve for attacking positions. He's not just the speed demon anymore. He's actually starting to have more of a complete game and bulking up a little bit to add some more power to his game, which is what you want to see from a guy that, like you said, was plateauing a little bit to that 15 to 25 range.
Yeah, exactly. And we saw that this year on the clay, right? When he had to like kind of generate his own pace and power from the back of the court and then find ways to attack the net. But yeah, I mean like the serve is a huge improvement, and he actually has a pretty good plus one behind it as well, where you feel like, okay, he's in a good position here to win some of these rallies by taking initiative. And I think that always wasn't his go-to because he always used to have those amazing highlights where he would just run balls down and he was like, Leighton Hewitt 2.0. But now I feel like he's utilizing all of his great IQ as well, combined with the improved serve. And and it feels like he can definitely keep this up for a couple of seasons, and then we'll see. Like, because a lot of people saying he's kind of like maximizing his potential and doing it, but I feel like, you know, even if it wasn't for the injury, I mean, he would
He
have
probably.
continued at a steady rate and would have gotten into the ATP finals much sooner.
I think
So
he also would have made a better run at the US Open.
yeah,
That's.
absolutely. I think the Wimbledon thing absolutely hurt because, you know, he was going to play Novak Djokovic next, and you know, just given where Djokovic was coming back from the knee surgery and given the momentum that Dimonor has, I think he would have had a really nice shot at that, at pushing Novak pretty hard there. So
Oh,
great.
100%. I agree. And if we look at the women's game, speaking of world number ones and finals, we have the WTA finals going on right now. And Sabalenka has officially secured the world number one ranking for the end of the year after Swiatek's loss to Coco Gauff in straight sets. It's well deserved for Sabalenka. And it's one of those where she's finally solidified her work on tour. Like we knew she could win Grand Slams, we knew she could win big titles, but it was always that number one spot. And I think going into the US Open, I was having this discussion with someone with Sabalenka. It was the only thing she hasn't achieved yet up until this point is world number one. And I think if she was able to pass Swiatek and maintain it earlier, she probably wouldn't have played as much before the finals. And she probably would have gone into the finals maybe even more relaxed or more casual because she already solidified it. But it seems like she really wanted to prove that she could be world number one and be in the history books for that.
Yeah, I think it's amazing because I think back to where she was at, you know, when she pulled out of Wimbledon, for instance, which was a big setback for her because she had that stomach illness in the quarterfinals against Mira Andreeva, and she had a really good momentum in the clay swing. And obviously we know she won Australia earlier in the year, but that Wimbledon shoulder injury time, I think she was really really wise about taking extra time off, skipping Wimbledon, not trying to get injured further, and you know, didn't look her best in DC, didn't look her best in Toronto, obviously skipped the Olympics. And then right from Cincinnati, she's just been dynamite. I mean, 22-1 since then. And obviously she has a win over Iga in the semis there as well, wins the title, doesn't drop a set along the way to Cincinnati title, loses just that one set to Alexandrova in her US Open run. And her last two matches really impressed me because she's playing against this crowd where it's so vocal for her inside Arthur Ashe with the roof closed. And obviously, she had to kind of face those same demons against Coco Gauff the year before. So just kind of the mental maturity of getting through that hump. And you look at her game now, and I feel like she doesn't panic in situations anymore because where she might have a year ago because she has that extra variety that she can lean on. I mean, the drop shot has been so good this year, the way she's kind of been able to kind of mix that in, come to the net, have other options at play rather than just beating herself, which she can still sometimes do in between matches. But she just wrestles it back immediately, and you just trust that she'll find her best level again. And that's what she keeps on doing, and you know, and then continuing that momentum after the US Open as well, and winning in Wuhan and kind of getting through some matches where she was in really sticky situations as well, but navigating through them. It really does feel like she's earned that number one ranking this year by because if you win two majors and you don't even play Wimbledon, and then you keep that run going for the entire second half of the year, I think there's no arguing with it that she's the best player in the world right now.
And for her too, it seems like she's powering through the mental toughness as well, right? Last year, it seemed like she would not crumble, but she didn't have that same fight that she did this past year, where it seems like she set a target out and she's sticking to it and she hasn't collapsed under anything, which is amazing to see for her, at least, because, like I said, it's something that we've always been looking to see from her. And we're finally getting that. I'm just wondering for you, and this is a little bit more impromptu, what makes her different than, because we know Azarenka is from the same country, no, Azarenka has won multiple slams. She's now tied with Sabalenka right now from slams, correct? Sabalenka has three,
Well,
she
she's
has
actually
three.
moved ahead because she's
She's,
won three now. So,
I
and Iga
thought
only.
Azarenka won three, or did she win two Aussies
She won
total?
Australia in 2012 and 2013. It was the U.S. Open that kind of eluded her because
I
she
got
got
it.
pretty close,
Okay.
three
Thank you.
finals I believe, but never ended up winning. And for a while, that was Sabalenka's major hurdle as well. You know, semifinal, you know, and then final, you know, last year. So it always felt like U.S. Open, she was knocking on the door, and she finally got that one this year.
So, what makes her I would say what would make her different than Azarenka as the kind of getting over that two slam shadow of Azarenka? What makes her a different player than Azarenka?
I mean, for me, I go back to like just wondering 2 years ago, she had those service yips at the end of 2021 and start of 2022, where she was double faulting like 20 plus times, and kind of it was pretty bad at some points. She was having to serve underhand, and when I realized, when I the more I thought about it, and when I realized that she finished that season number five in the world, even with all those double faults and all those yips, and kind of had to go back in the garage and work on a few things tactically. Got the biomechanics specialist as well, and just kind of like mentally just transformed herself. And when she went through something like that, I kind of feel like the floodgates just opened for her, in the sense that you look at like every major, she's basically at the back end, semis, finals, titles consistently. Obviously, Vika, she ran into Serena when Serena was really starting to rack them up in that 2012 to 2017 period. But I never really felt like she had maximized her serve potential in the way that Azarenka has. I mean, in the way that Sabalenka really has at this point, where like first serve, second serve, and that she can work through the kinks when she, because the double faults do come back at some points in her matches still, but like she always just finds a way through them. It doesn't really affect the rest of her game, as when it comes to just how much power she can produce off of both wings. And the crazy thing for me is like when she's out of position, when she's on the back foot, she still kind of goes for those shots when she's not in balance, which I wouldn't always recommend if I was like, let's say, coaching a junior or something like that. But she just finds a way to kind of like trust her plan A in those moments. And if it doesn't work, now she actually has more of a plan B. Whereas I feel like last year, she was kind of hitting herself out of those semifinals, like against Muhova in the semis of the French, against Ons Jabeur in the semis of Wimbledon, and then even against Goff in the final. And now she just sort of is like way more calm and way more chill about it in those moments. And once you kind of win that second one, I feel like then the floodgates really open, right? Because there's a big difference between winning no slams and one slam, and there's a big difference between winning one and two. But after two, everything else is just kind of gravy at that point, and you're just kind of adding to the collection. And that's where Sabalenka really is right now. She could really end up, in that 6 through 8 range, and wouldn't surprise me. She's at the peak of her power. She's only 26, but she feels a lot older than that because she arrived
I
on the
know.
scene in like 2017, 18. So it's like kind of a, she feels like a veteran, but she's in her prime.
And for her, are you sticking to that 6 to 8 range? Do you ever think she could get to double digits? Because I feel like she would be on the cusp of, depending if Swiatek ever lets up on the French. I was thinking more to the 7 to, I wouldn't say 12, I would say probably 8 to 10 range for her.
Yeah, I think nothing would really surprise me there. I think it just depends on who else is really gonna, come
Pop.
up. Is Goff really gonna be pushing and challenging her? For instance, that's a intriguing matchup every time Goff and Sabalenka really play. Is Mira Andreeva gonna suddenly come out and 2 years from now, win her first major or something? Or is there anyone else kind of in that next generation? Is Xin Wen, who's already a big star, gonna kind of, close the gap in that rivalry? So it kind of depends on the other players at this point, but right now, Sabalenka and Iga, they really have that thing going where,
It's tough
Swiatek,
too.
Roland Garros, and then Sabalenka, Australian Open. And it didn't, I wouldn't say like Sabalenka has the same level of reliability right now at the Australian Open as like Iga does on at Roland Garros, but it's getting up there. Like, I mean, it's, if she wins three
That's
in a
true.
row, then that's a different league, right? So
That's a different league, especially with Iga now doing it with the French. And I think the only one that we question, at least talking about those two, is Wimbledon. That's the more up in the air one, and that seemed like it was Ons until she lost her second straight Wimbledon final. And it's sad to see, but it became Ons in no offense to her, just the mental side of it just was crushing, because you could see it on her. Like, she wanted it too much, and that's what seems to be a common theme with a lot of these players, or at least on the women's side. Like, you look at Maria Sakkari, like, wants it so badly that she gets in her own way. On Jabeur, like, second time Wimbledon, has the possibility of doing it, especially playing someone like Marqueta. It's hard to see, because the reality of the situation becomes, crap, I actually have a real shot at winning this. How do I not literally freeze up? And it seems like it's happening to a lot of them.
Yeah, for sure. And Wimbledon is kind of the outlier one where, we've had Krejcikova won it this year. We had Vondrousova the year, the year before, Ash Barty the year before. I think it's kind of, yeah. Like I mean, Ons's 2023 run was amazing because she made four Grand Slam champions along the way, and she finally got over that hump where it wasn't like 2022 where you really felt like okay, the draw gods were kind of in her favor. She gets to the final, she's playing Rybakina, who then became like a season top player, and it was kind of more excusable. It was like the first final for her, right? But then this third one, I think, really stung because she knew the brevity of that moment. She knew like this was it. And I think it just, she was just so flat and so overcome by the occasion and the nerves in a way that I just hadn't seen before. And the scarring of that match, I mean, we'll never know if like, I really hope we can get her back healthy because I think that's also been a big struggle for her is just like finding, for a lot of these players, are just like getting in that healthy frame where you're playing like 6 months straight without any kind of setbacks and injuries, and then to rework and restart all of that all over again, especially when you're like 30, 31, and you're kind of getting to the, that stage in your career where the scar tissue is really like building up, and you're kind of gonna get asked about it until you actually get over the hump. And that's what I think. Yeah, I mean, if they get asked about it so much, it's obviously something in the back of their mind that you can't shake the feeling, but.
And for Ons too, it's hard to see that because I feel like Wimbledon is, honestly, maybe the French too, but it seems like the different speed surfaces really play into her game well with her variety. And she for me at least, and I don't know if you'll agree with this, but she reminds me of Barty in the amount of variety and kind of quick thinking about strategy. With her backhand and powering through her forehand, she has that variety, but it seems like Wimbledon and the French are the only two slams that she has even a shot at winning. Because hard court, it's the like you said, the way courts are going now with that speed, it doesn't seem like she has a possibility of even making the final four at some of these hard court tournaments.
Yeah, I feel like the craftiness that she has is really well suited to the natural surfaces because the drop shots just work so well on grass and clay. And just the surprise factor is really there. But if she's playing on a hard court and she's a little underpowered from the baseline in some moments and maybe doesn't get that extra help from her serve or just other parts of her game where she can't have those reliable patterns, that's when I feel like she's kind of suspect to being hit off the court or maybe just you also see some more injuries as well. I think it's softer on the knees, the clay and the grass as well, and grass especially the deeper you go into the tournament. So I kind of feel like, yeah, there's all those other extra factors. And it was nice to see her kind of have that run in 2022 and 2023 on both surfaces at some points, winning Charleston or like getting to the US Open final. But I still feel like that US Open final, a little bit of an anomaly for her on hard court. She's a little bit she's not quite at like a 70% win rate like she is on grass and clay on hard. So always something to monitor, but
I mean, I hope the best for her and being one of
yeah.
the most positive, I would say, the minister of happiness right now. I feel like it's like the newer version of Miss Sunshine with Caroline Wozniacki. If we're looking at
Yeah.
nicknames, it's kind of similar to that.
It's a good one, yeah.
Thank you. Another women's player that I wanted to point out was Coco Gauff, one of the more famous coaching splits. Same with, if we look at coaching splits, we're looking at Rybakina dropping hers, Naomi splitting with Wim, Brad Gilbert with Coco Gauff. Sakkari is now with David Witt, or are they split as well?
They split up earlier in the year. I think it was after the French Open that
So
they
it's
split.
like Jessica Pegula is another one of those that David Witt was with. Now he's working with Tiafoe. But if we look at Coco Gauff, I think that's the biggest headline we have to look at in terms of coaching carousels. Who's gonna do it? Who's gonna bring Gauff back to winning the US Open?
Well, I'll tell you, Brad is one of those players who's had great runs with players immediately, right? I mean, Andy Roddick comes to mind in 2003, right? He's not sure if he can play on grass, and then he just goes on this incredible tear from like Queens and then wins the US Open and just has like an amazing summer, like winning all the lead up tournaments. Gauff kind of did a similar thing by, hitting rock bottom at Wimbledon and then throughout the US Open, and then completing that magical summer, and then kind of the honeymoon period of that relationship went away for a bit, right? And we saw some of those things come back in her game in some crucial moments. But I think Brad's philosophy is always scout, focus on the next opponent, be let's not focus on the forehand weakness too much. Let's bring in other aspects of her game and let's hone in on that. And that's still pretty good. It still wins her a ton of matches. Her floor is still pretty high. She's still the world number three, right? But I think there comes to a point where obviously, like, you need something different. You need a new, fresh, new voice. Even if it's just a little technical tweak and not going completely back in the garage like Sabalenka did, but just something a little bit different. And how you say it to the player makes a big difference, I think. But and after a while, we saw some tense exchanges between them and Wimbledon. They're back and forth in the box at the US Open as well, and afterwards as well with Renee Stubbs in the ESPN booth. Brad was really put under an immense amount of scrutiny. So it kind of seemed like it was on the cards that this relationship wasn't going to last forever at that point. So I wasn't too shocked when they split up. And then it was just about, okay, who is she going to hire next? Because does she want to go for the really high profile coach now, or does she kind of want to go for a coach where, that's maybe like less high profile, but somebody who can work on like specifics in her game? And the Matt Daly partnership is interesting because obviously I know he worked with Denis Shapovalov, but also he and Jessica Pegula's coach, one of Jessica Pegula's coaches, Mark Markline, they have this. I think you know where I'm going with this. It's a thing called Grip MD,
I
and I
have
think when
it.
everyone saw that,
I
they
have
were
it.
like, okay, yeah. And obviously you have that device, right, that you can just slip onto your racket and.
It's a cool device. It works. It's just it's very different. I've been meaning to make a video on that. And if we look at some of the, I guess for her, actually, let me come back to that thought because I just want to say when you put, and this is my own opinion here, when you put a coach that's coaching a current player on a panel that's then going to grill you, and you're doing two jobs, but trying to keep being neutral in broadcasting, how the hell is that going to work? Like, explain to me how Brad Gilbert intended to go into that environment and not expect questions like that. How do you, even for Renee Stubbs, I thought she went a little too hard on him, but it's like, how are you expected to do both? There's no way you can be neutral throughout the entire tournament and still coached a top five player in the world. Maybe that's just me, but that's you're no offense, you might be asking for it. Some would see it that way.
Yeah, I think it was just so quick after the match as well, right? Like he had no time to sort of process and digest what just took place on the court. And he's having to kind of run to the ESPN booth and just like put on his,
Doesn't even talk to her too. It feels like he didn't even have like a he didn't decompress with Coco either. It's like I
I
can't
think
talk
that's
to
what
you
made
right
the
now. I have to do my other job. That's not why you're hired. That's
Yeah, I
not
think that's also what like made the whole exchange just very just
tense.
very tense to watch, right? Like because you see Brad getting grilled, and what is he supposed to say in that moment? Because he's, obviously he's supposed to be kind of neutral. He wants to kind of, Emma Navarro's moving on in the rest of the tournament, kind of project where she's going to be headed in the quarterfinal match. And it's such an awkward position to put yourself in just minutes after losing and just flip that switch to go from like, coach to like neutral, analyst
You can't.
on the studio. So it's tough. I felt for him in that moment, certainly. And some of the backlash that he probably would have got, but I mean,
What is he
at
supposed
some
to say?
point.
Like, what is he supposed to say? Like you said, like, oh, she served terribly. I didn't teach her that. Like, what do you, like, how do you respond to
Yeah,
that?
and
You
I think
can't.
he made the point that like in practice, we can go out of the court right now and we can hit 20 or 30 of these serves, and Coco's going to make every single one of them. And I think Coco echoed those thoughts at her press conference as well. But obviously then the natural question is, well, everyone can do it in practice. So what are you doing about it technique-wise to get her to not do it in the match? Or are we just not focusing on that at that point? And obviously, to answer that on set with an honest answer would be like just giving away his secrets. So I think that, I think, yeah, it was a tough situation for him. And, certainly I think someone else maybe should have come in and stepped in that moment. And maybe the day after, once he's digested the loss, or 24 hours later, you can go back to it if you really want. But
Did
yeah.
Renee get flamed for that?
I think actually from what I saw on Twitter, and I mean, I don't know because like I only read, whatever some of the comments, but It was actually Brad who was like, I think a lot of people were just like, wow, Renee cooks Brad here in this moment, and kind of that like audio became viral for a while, which is what I listened to. But I went back and also watched it on TV, and
It's
it was an
worse.
uncomfortable watch for sure. Yeah.
It's worse when you watch it again. You're like, I know what's coming, and I can't do anything about it.
Yeah. But also Renee is one of those people who really just kind of goes hard, right in and just nosedives, and sometimes it's good to have someone like that. So she's a unique
There's
one in that
positives and
way.
negatives to the whole situation with it too, and
Yeah.
the way I see that too is like you can, you mentioned it with giving away secrets. It's like you can only limit yourself to saying what works and what doesn't, and it's like a football coach going on college game day to describe, okay, these are our plays that we're running this for this week. And it's like, no, you don't want to say that. You're gonna point out what you're gonna try to exploit on the other team without telling them how you're going to do it. So it works both ways.
Exactly.
So if we looked at, I guess the last thing I wanted to talk about was the Hall of Fame nominations. And even though I didn't make a video on this, there was Sharapova, the Bryan brothers, both got into the Hall of Fame this year, but one name that kind of lingered was Daniel Nestor. And I was thinking about it the other day and doing when I was looking deep diving into his career, I didn't realize how impactful he was on the game of doubles and became almost like the rival to the Bryan brothers during that time. And I was just thinking to myself, was he snubbed in a way? Because you go from two, technically three icons of the game that are automatically going to get in no matter what year they're nominated. And you have Daniel, who's probably going to go up against more people that may not have the same resume as he does. So it made me curious to think about the situation.
It was definitely very surprising for me that he didn't get in, and he didn't get the majority of the votes either, which is really stunning because how did he not get like 75% of the votes at least? You have a career like his who's like 27 years on the tour. He's won like 8 majors in doubles. He's won like 4 mixed titles. He's won, I think, 91 doubles titles overall.
Yeah,
Like
he's
he's
only
played
behind
across
the
three
Bryans.
decades.
Yeah,
He's played
that's
across 3 decades. Like you said, his career very much rivaled the Bryans. It would have been so fitting had they went in together. In
yeah.
some ways, and we could have had a great moment together on the stage,
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
it would have been just so wonderful. And I think it also sets a like a really tough precedent moving forward because you look at someone like, let's say, Sara Errani, right, who now has the Olympic, or
Gold.
now has the Golden Slam, right, because she won the gold and she's also won all the 4 majors in doubles. And so it's like if she's not going to get in, she's definitely not going to get in because if Daniel Nestor didn't get in, how is she gonna? So I think it just raises the bar so high now because. Obviously, I mean, Nestor's not a household name, maybe like the Bryans, but his career is like maybe the most comparable to any of the other doubles legends. I mean, if you have like Leander Paes as well,
Yeah.
who I very much deserves to be there, and like Vijay, Amritraj, and these, the kind of representation we had this year for the
Yeah.
Hall of Fame. I don't see why Nestor doesn't really fit that category. And it's very surprising even for someone like Greg Sharkoe, who is. Been the head of the ATP stats for a long time, like since 1986,
I'm surprised he
and
even
to see it
tweeted
today.
about it.
Yeah, and he was so like forthright about it immediately. Like, they really missed the beat on this.
Like, even just saying, like, how do you, like, if laying out all the important stats that Daniel had, it's, I didn't even think about having the doubles guys all do it at the same year. That would have been, just from an optic perspective, like, that's what you want. And I don't know if it's saying something about what you need to achieve, the representation of doubles, too. Like, does that, how do I say this without being mean, but it's like, is it like a shot at the doubles community saying, like, you need to be a super icon of the game to get into the Hall of Fame? Because what more do you have to do as a doubles player to get in? Because he did everything. literally everything.
Yeah, I mean, he has like so many matches won, like over 1,000 matches across like I said, almost 3 decades. So it's he really kind of moved the needle as well, especially for Canadian tennis too. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
you know, we always think of like Milos Raonic and some of the other young players that are coming up now, but Nestor was always the guy they looked up to. Like, he was the one. So for him not to get this award, it's a big shame. And hopefully, I mean, I don't know. I haven't gotten many answers as to like what happened, why he was snubbed so bad here, but I really think they did him dirty.
Didn't Rothenberg tweet out who voted for him?
I don't remember that. I have to go and go back and see, but
I'll see if I can find it and send it to you, but I thought I saw something there. I could be wrong, but I can't thank you enough for joining us today. I really do appreciate it. If you guys don't follow this man on Twitter, I highly recommend you do. It's one of the best ones that you can follow when it comes to tennis content, and basically giving you the need to know facts, stats, and all the storylines. So I really appreciate you joining, man. It's always a pleasure having you on, and I would love to have you back sometime in the future.
yeah, man, I loved the candid chat, and I loved all the topics we covered today. And yeah, happy to do this anytime soon. And you know, let's keep growing the game.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Thank you guys so much for watching and listening, and I hope to see you guys in the next one. Thank you so much.
Cheers.